Om sahana vavatu sahanau bhunaktu saha vidyan karavavahai tejasvi navadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi chaitanyam sarvagam sarvam sarva bhuta guhashayam yat sarva vishayatitam tasmai sarva vide namaha. Om, good. Welcome back. Welcome also to all of you watching these classes online. Nice to have you join us, of course. We continue this. This is an excellent chapter. I'm enjoying it a lot. of Shankara's Upadesha Sahasri. And in today's class, we'll just see a few verses today, and they just so clearly lay out the sadhana, the practice of Atma-vichara, self, inquiry. And this is the fundamentals of Advaita Vedanta. By the way, fundamentals are more important than anything else, right? If you master everything, think about it. If you master everything else except the fundamentals, how would that help you? So please don't assume that when I say we're going to be discussing fundamentals, that somehow this is all going to be very simple and basic. That's not the point at all. This is where the real essence and purpose of these teachings is found. So that Atma-vichara is a central practice of Atma-vichara, threefold practice we'll describe in just a moment, because the purpose of Vedanta is to solve the problem of suffering. Suffering arises due to your identification with the problems of your body and mind. Identification with the body. Is it going up? No? Okay, my ears are funny. Identification with the body and mind naturally take place when you fail to understand your true nature. Your true nature as pure consciousness. And one more time, pure consciousness is not an idea or a concept. Pure consciousness is you. Who knows what's happening right now? Is it a conscious being or an unconscious being that knows what's happening right now? You are that conscious being who knows what's happening right now. So the consciousness we're talking about is not some abstract entity. It's you in your essential nature, but that essential nature is not fully known. The purpose of Vedanta is to help you fully recognize your nature as pure consciousness, Satchidananda Atma, and thereby destroy the identification with the body and mind, and thereby put an end to human suffering. You continue to have a body and mind, but it no longer affects you. Nothing can affect you. So this is our theme. So that Atma-vichara, and just to introduce our verses for today, that Atma-vichara, as you know, is threefold. We have this threefold foundation for the whole teachings of Vedanta. You've heard many times here before, Shruti, Yukti, Anubhava. That will be our topic again today. Shruti, scripture, scriptural revelation, the discoveries of the ancient rishis. What we're doing is using the teachings of the ancient rishis to discover what they discovered. So they left for us what could be compared to a roadmap. By following the so-called roadmap left to us by the ancient rishis, we have the opportunity to walk in their footsteps, in a manner of speaking, and discover what they discovered. That's the purpose of Shruti. But then, as you know very well, this is not our relationship with Scripture is very different than in Western religious traditions. In Western religious traditions, whatever Scripture says is a matter of faith. You just have to accept it. Blind faith, andhavishwasa. You just accept whatever Scripture says. That is certainly not the case in Vedanta's relationship or our relationship with Scripture. But rather, whatever is revealed by Scripture, we test by rules of logic. Is it reasonable? Is it logical? Does it make sense? This is the second of our three pillars, so to speak, of Vedanta, Shruti and Yukti, reasoning, Scripture and reasoning or logic. So nothing is taken as a matter of faith. Everything is tested through logical reasoning, which means anything that's illogical gets rejected. Suppose you looked at other scriptures, Western scriptures, and you went through and with this kind of like comb of logic, and you removed everything in the scripture that was illogical. You went through the Bible, and you remove everything that is contrary to scripture. How much would you remove as being unreasonable or illogical? I don't know how familiar you are with those scriptures, but a lot anyway. So, and we're not done yet. We set a threefold basis for this atma-vichara, self-inquiry, because not only do we begin with the scripture, the roadmap of the ancient rishis, and then we test all of it with reasoning. By the way, that reasoning is also important to clarify what they taught. Sometimes things are not clear, and we use a lot of metaphors. We use some reasoning to make whatever was said by the ancient rishis lived in such an ancient time, some of their expressions may be hard for us to grasp. So we also use that yukti to better grasp the teachings of the ancient rishi. And that leads us to the third of our three foundations, which is anubhava, experience. So if something is said by the ancient rishis in scripture, and if we confirm it with reasoning, if it's contrary to your experience, we still reject it. So we reject not only on the base of logical inconsistency, but anything that's not consistent with your experience gets rejected. This teaching is all about your experience. Your experience as a conscious being. So necessarily, experience is central in this pursuit, which makes it very different than philosophy. Many people call this philosophy. Philosophy is something quite different. Here, we're focused on human experience, and that anubhava, or experience, is central. Both your experience is crucial, also the experience of the ancient rishis, the enlightened ones. We learn from their experiences. Okay, that is enough introduction. So let us pick up the thread and we will see illustrations. Maybe put the mouse on that PowerPoint. There we go. Thank you. So we will continue. Amanaskasya kachinta, amanaskasya kachinta, kriyavanindriyasya ka, kriyavanindriyasya ka, aprano hyamana shubhra, aprano hyamana shubhra, iti sat. Yam shuter vachaha, iti yam shuter vachaha. Start at the bottom. This is the Shutehe vachanam, the teaching of the scripture, the teaching of the ancient rishis. And that teaching of the ancient rishis is satyam. It is true. And why is it true? Because it's going to be confirmed by yukti and anubhava. We know shruti, we know the scriptures are true because we confirm them with our experience and with logic. And experience, I forgot to mention one clever comment of Sri Shankaracharya with regard to experience. He said famously in a commentary, he said, and Shankara, of course, is the author of our text today, he said, if thousands of scriptures were to declare that fire is cold, Shankara says, reject them all. Why give them the benefit of the doubt? If they are contrary to experience, they get rejected. So these scriptures, however, are satyam. They are satyam true because, as I said, they're confirmed by yukti, supported by reasoning, and personally validated by anubhava, by experience, all three. And what is it that is taught by the scriptures? Iti puts a prior line in quotation marks, and here Shankaracharya makes a famous quotation from the Mundaka Upanishad. Of course, the Upanishads are the words of those rishis. So he is quoting the very words of the rishis who said about Atma, Atma is apranaha, hi amanaha, and shubraha. Atma is your true nature, shubraha, shining. And we use that all the time in a sense of awareness, consciousness. The metaphor we use again and again is just like light reveals objects in a dark room. In the same way, the so-called light of consciousness reveals the activities of your mind. Think of your mind as a room. In fact, better yet, think of your mind as a room with walls painted black, the floor painted black, the ceiling painted black, but there are a bunch of objects inside that dark room which you can't see until you bring in some kind of light. And instantly, that light reveals the contents of that black room. Black room represents mind. Your mind is full of objects, objects like thoughts, objects like emotions, objects like perceptions, what you see and hear right now. All of those mental objects, we call them vrittis, are present in your mind. They are illumined by consciousness, and that consciousness is you. Who is it that recognizes the objects in your mind? You or someone else? Obviously. You as pure consciousness. How simple it is. You as pure consciousness recognize whatever is happening in your mind right now. And the rishi uses the word shubhra, shining, to describe that consciousness. Further, that consciousness is apranaha, independent of prana, independent of your life force, independent of your physical body, independent of the powers of your body to walk and talk and move, independent of the life force that animates your body, independent of all of that, apranaha. Does your consciousness, the consciousness that knows what's happening in your body, in your mind right now, what is the relationship between that consciousness and your physical body and all of the attributes of your body? Are they identical or different? How obvious. that consciousness that illumines what's happening in your mind is not a physical thing like your body. We make this distinction all the time between knower and known. Consciousness is the awareful knower, the awareful witness, sakshi, we can call it in Sanskrit, and as such, utterly independent from all that is known, including physical body. The Rishi says, apranaha, that consciousness is utterly separate from your body and all the faculties of your body. He, we have to break the words apart, he, amanaha, he, and indeed, amanaha, your consciousness, that consciousness is amanaha, literally means mindless, which is a kind of odd expression, but making a very important point. Just as consciousness is independent of your body, I asked you a moment ago, what is the relationship between consciousness, you, and your body? You are the knower, body is known. Anything known to you is different from you. This is our simple logic. Apply it not to the body now, but apply it to your mind. Is your mind and its activities known to you or not? Hey, just as you are the knower of your body, you are the knower of whatever is happening in your mind. If the mind is known to you, you must be different from the mind. Knower has to be different from the known. Otherwise, how can you have a relationship? If there's no difference between knower and known, there's only one. You can't have a knower-known relationship. Relationship requires two. So, just as you are the knower of your physical body and therefore separate from your physical body, you are the knower of the activities of your mind and therefore separate from the activities of your mind. This was discovered by the ancient rishis and given to us in this so-called roadmap, the scriptures, in this particular case, the Mundaka Upanishad. We start with Shruti. Look at the first half now. Would you be surprised if it was yukti? That's what it is. Look. He says, amanaskasya kachinta. I like this language. He says, amanaskasya, for one who has no mind. Who are we referring to? You, in your essential nature, as pure consciousness, right? So for you as pure consciousness, the one who has no mind, amanaskasya, for that mindless one, for pure consciousness, ka chinta, how can there be any thinking? Let me point out something that's a little ironic. Thinking and mental activities in general are the source of all your suffering, are they not? Suppose your mind was perfectly still. Would you suffer? There'd be no suffering whatsoever. So all mental activities, now many, many mental activities are pleasant. You know, what's going on right now, I think, is quite pleasant. But some mental activities are extremely unpleasant. Physical pain, emotional grief, worry about paying your bills or whatever. All of these are mental activities that cause great suffering. All of these are called here chinta. Well, in a general sense, it can mean worry, but here in a more general sense, it means all mental activities. So amanaskasya, for one who has no mind, kachinta. How can there be any mental activities? If you have no mind, you have no mental activities. If you have no mental activities, you have no suffering. Similarly for the body, he says, breaking words apart, va, or anindriyasya, for one who has no organs, no body, no capacities to move, walk, talk, no powers of sight, hearing, taste, smell, or touch, one who has no life force, for that person who is anindriya, free from all the body and all of its attributes, for such a person, ka kriya, what actions could be performed? And to connect that to our previous topics, we generally have the sense of how to describe it. Everyone seems to feel that there is something that needs to be done, an agenda, a to-do list. And conventionally, people feel compelled to continue to tick off all those items on their to-do list, to fulfill all their responsibilities, or what do they call, bucket list also, before you die, tick off all of those items. So conventionally, people are committed to action, activity. By the way, does that ever make you tired? A lot. We accomplish a lot in our lives, but at a cost. The cost is the expenditure of energy. We get tired. We get exhausted. So here the message then is anindriyasya, if your sense, your consciousness is independent of your body and all of its activities, then ka kriya, what actions are produced by consciousness? It was a funny question. Does consciousness ever get tired? Interesting. By the way, an important point to make right here. Sometimes people think that when I wake up in the morning, my consciousness seems dull. Then after a big cup of coffee, my consciousness shines brightly. Absolutely incorrect. By the way, nothing wrong with the coffee. That's not where the problem lies. The problem lies in your assumption that it's consciousness that was dull and consciousness that becomes bright. Consciousness doesn't change. We've had many classes in which we've talked about the fact that consciousness is unchanging. We won't talk about that right now. But here's the point. That dullness that you feel when you first wake up, is it known to you or not? Oh. If it's known to you, the dullness is an attribute of your mind, is it not? And it's known to consciousness. And when, after the coffee, your mind is bright, you feel that brightness. Again, that brightness is a mental quality known to you, consciousness. The point I'm making, consciousness doesn't get bright or dull. Consciousness doesn't get tired or fatigued or exhausted. All these problems exist, but thank goodness they're not your problems. They belong to the body. They belong to the mind. And here, my guru said it very nicely. When the problems are not yours, when there is some distance between you and your problems, not physical distance, conceptual distance. You know that you are unchanging consciousness, unaffected by the problems of the mind, but yet the body and mind have problems, so there is a conceptual distance between you and those problems. That distance allows you to convert, and this is his exact words, you convert problems into situations. A problem is something that makes you suffer. A situation is something you deal with. Do it. Take care of it. So if the body is ill, for many people, that's very threatening. But for an enlightened one, it's just like you take your car to the shop to get it fixed. You take the body to the doctor to get it fixed. It's not a problem. It's a situation. This is the result of these teachings. Now notice how this yukti was crucial after the shruti. This reasoning we've just used is crucial to follow this yukti, this shruti, this scriptural statement. The scripture says, I'll just paraphrase. Scripture says you are not your body or mind. And conceptually you get it. I am the knower, the body and mind are known. That's it. But it's almost always the case that even though you conceptually know you are not the body and mind, you continue to be identified with the body and mind. Habitual identification. We've talked about that in this class many times. This conditioning we've had from infancy, we get so identified with the body and mind that even though you conceptually understand, I'm not my body and mind, if your body is male, you say, I am a man. If your body is female, you say, I'm a woman. Wait a minute. I thought you knew that you're not your body. Then why do you refer to yourself as a man or woman? Habitual identification. You know better, but out of habit, you continue to identify with body and mind. Similarly for the mind. When you're sad, I've used this example before. When you're sad, do you say there is sadness present in my mind? No one talks like that. Actually, I might talk like that. but in general, you say, I am sad. Again, that habitual identification. How to get rid of that habitual identification, that's the purpose of this yukti. So the scripture says you're not your body and mind, then we use some reasoning to understand. If I'm not my body and mind, then the problems of my body belong to the body, the problems of my mind belong to the mind, and as pure consciousness, I have no problems, no suffering. This is the yukti, the reasoning that follows the scripture. So, first shruti, scripture, then yukti, reasoning, and finally anubhava, experience. Oh, I went the wrong way. There we go. Akala twara desha twat, akala twara desha twat, adiktvad hanimittataha, adiktvad anamittataha, atmano naiva kaladir, atmano naiva kaladir, apeksha dhyayata sada, apeksha dhyayata sada. Talking about experience now, in particular, the experience, we'll start at the end, dhyayataha, the experience of a meditator. Obviously, an experienced meditator. A meditator who is capable of making one's mind perfectly silent, perfect stillness. So, in that state of meditation, dhyayataha, in that condition of deep meditation, one line up, atmanaha, for atma, for your true nature as pure consciousness, naiva, na, eva, apeksha. There is no apeksha, no dependence, no connection, sada, at all times. There is no connection with what? Kala, adi, with time, etc. And this is actually a reference to the first half of the verse, which we're going to see right now. So, first of all, second half of the verse says, in deep meditation, there is no dependence, no connection to time, etc. Why? He says in the first half, akala twat, right at the beginning. Kala means time. And something that people don't think about is that how do you experience time? This is interesting. How do you experience time? Do you have some organ in your brain that senses time, like a clock? Yet, we do sense time. And we often sense it fairly accurately. We have a good sense that this class has gone on for a half an hour or more. So you get that sense. We have a sense of time. How? Based on the number of thoughts in your mind, the amount of mental activity. Time is experienced according to the amount of activity in your mind. More activity means you experience more time. Which is why when you're really anxious and worried, you experience more time, and the clock seems to slow down. Conversely, when your mind is very calm, there's less activity, you experience less time, so the clock seems to speed up. So, my point here, or Shankara's point here, is the experience of time is due to the mind. In deep meditation, the mind is perfectly quiet. You don't experience time. For me, it's not always, but in some of my meditations, I close my eyes. It takes a while to make the mind quiet, but then I open my eyes later, and it's like 10, 15 minutes have disappeared somehow. You experience no time in deep meditation. Similarly, adeshatvat, you experience no place. Before you become absorbed in stillness, you feel like you are in your body, sitting in your place for meditation. You feel like you're in a particular place at a particular time, until your mind becomes silent. Then, no experience of time, no experience of place. Adiktvat, obviously. If you don't experience place, you don't experience directions. Dik is directions. So there's no... When your mind is perfectly silent, do the concepts up and down have any meaning? That's what Shankara is saying here. Spatial directions have no meaning when your mind is silent. And finally, animittaha. There is no, very serious language here, no causality. No causality. Time, space, causality. These are the three factors that make up conventional life: time, space, and causality. Causality means there's a process. There's a cause and effect. Then the effect causes something else. Then that causes something else. There's a causal chain set in motion. All of that disappears in deep meditation. What is the point? The point is, you are, in deep meditation, you continue to be that pure consciousness, right? That doesn't change. Mind changes, but your nature as pure consciousness doesn't change. In deep meditation, you as pure consciousness, you find yourself free from time, space, and causality. Now, listen very carefully. In deep meditation, consciousness is free from time, space, and causality. When your meditation comes to an end, your mind changes, but not consciousness. Consciousness continues to be free from time, space, and causality even now. Wow! This is the use of experience. Your experience in deep meditation, obviously you should learn to meditate if you don't already meditate. You can use that meditation to confirm, personally discover what the ancient rishis discovered. You can see how crucial and important it is. Also important to learn how to meditate properly, so you can do that. But the point of the verse is this. Even if you can't meditate that deeply, you can still appreciate this truth. What is that truth? The consciousness in deep meditation is free from time, space, and causality. And when your meditation comes to an end, the mind is affected by time, space, and causality, but pure consciousness remains free from time, space, and causality, even when you're awake. Okay, let's see one more verse. Oh, this is just wonderful poetry. I think you'll like it. Yasmin devash, I'm sorry. Yasmin devashcha vedashcha, yasmin devashcha vedashcha, pavitram kritsnam ekatam, pavitram kritsnam ekatam, vrajetan manasam tirtam, vrajetan manasam tirtam, yasmin snatva mrito bhavet, yasmin snatva mrito bhavet. Start in the third line. It's a beautiful metaphor. He says, vrajet, suppose you go to a tirtam. Some of you know that word. It describes a holy place. In India, there are so many tirthams, holy places, places of pilgrimage, places where there are sacred temples, places where there are sacred rivers, and so on. So these are called tirthams, holy places. By going there, you are blessed. But the tirtham we're talking, that Shankara is describing here, is not a tirtham in India, like Varanasi or Rishikesh or any of these places. The tirtham described here is Manasa tirtham, a place of pilgrimage in your mind, a mental pilgrimage, vrajet. One who undergoes this mental pilgrimage, what is this mental pilgrimage? The use of the use of shruti, yukti, and anubhava. This is our mental pilgrimage to discover your true nature as Satchidananda, Atma. So to undergo a physical pilgrimage, you might get on a train or get in a taxi in India. But here, what is the means of undergoing this mental pilgrimage? Obviously not by taxi or train, but then how? Shruti, yukti, anubhava. By means of these three vehicles, the vehicle of scripture, vehicle of reasoning, vehicle of your own experience, these three so-called vehicles lead you on an inner pilgrimage. Now, the metaphor is quite nice. He expands it further. Generally, when you go to a holy place in India, you bathe. You know, if it's a temple, the temple will have a pond. They call it tank. If you go to other places, Rishikesh, Hardwar, Varanasi, there'll be the river, like the Ganges, Ganga. You bathe in the Ganga. So one of the important parts of the pilgrimage is to bathe in that sacred river. That's what he says in the next line, Yasmin Snatva. Having bathed in that pilgrimage place. Which pilgrimage place are we talking about? Not Rishikesh Hardwar. We're talking about this mental pilgrimage place. Having bathed in that mental... What in the world does that mean? This is poetry. This is metaphor. So, to bathe in that mental pilgrimage place, Shruti, Yukti, and Anubhava are the vehicle that leads you to the mental pilgrimage place. Then bathing is the culmination of a pilgrimage in India. And here, discovery of your true nature as Satchidananda Atma is the culmination of this inner pilgrimage. So, the discovery of your true nature as Satchidananda is the equivalent then of bathing in the sacred place, in a place of pilgrimage, and yasmin, in that place. In what place? That mental place of pilgrimage. And he describes that further in the, the first half. Yes, you see yasmin again. That yasmin, in that mental place of pilgrimage, in which Kritsnam Pavitram, in the second line, all that is holy, all that is divine, all that is pure, including Devaha, including the gods, Vedaha cha, including the sacred scriptures, the Vedas. So that place of utter sanctity, that's what Shankara wants us to see here. The most sacred place you could imagine is a place where all of these ekatam, they all come together, they unify in that place of incredible sanctity. What is present is all that is holy and pure and sacred is concentrated at that mental pilgrimage place. And when you bathe there, figuratively speaking, meaning when you discover your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, then what? The last two words, Amritaha bhavet. One becomes, literally, one becomes immortal. One becomes liberated from worldly suffering. One becomes enlightened after bathing. The commentator makes a nice observation. He says, like a river, when the river merges into the ocean. The river loses its identity in the ocean. This is the observation made by the commentator. Here's the idea. Having bathed in that most sacred place, that mental pilgrimage place, and having discovered your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, then you, as pure consciousness represented by that holy stream in the pilgrimage place, just as streams merge into the ocean, you, as pure consciousness, merge, figuratively speaking, into... And we have to set up the language properly here. Your consciousness is not yours. We've had this discussion before. There is only one consciousness. You are all little flickers of that consciousness, all little reflections of that consciousness, but all those reflections are reflections of one and the same consciousness. So when that river meets the sea, it loses its individuality, its constrictedness. So the river is confined by the banks. But when that river finally gets to the ocean, becomes vast. So the vastness of the ocean is attained by the river. The vastness of all pervasive consciousness is reached by discovering your true nature. What a beautiful metaphor. I really, really enjoyed that. Okay, this is actually a good place to stop for today. We'll continue next week. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityorma Amritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Tat Sat. Very nice.